Hello and welcome to The Wire, your national and independent coverage of current affairs right across Australia on community and Indigenous radio. I'm Tony Pankaluk, coming to you from Radio 4EB in Meanjin, Brisbane. And today on the show...
So essentially the study combines First Nations seasonal calendar with a novel deep learning model, an artificial intelligence technique to predict future solar panel power output.
A new research shows how important it is to incorporate First Nations knowledge into science. We have all the details. Also, why is it important to set up AI ethics into uni students' curriculum? And later today...
On a weekend, I saw an art show over there, incognito art show in Ireland, and I took part as a buyer. And I thought that if such an interesting show can get me out of bed and waiting 3 hours in line, just thought that it was something that could work really well in Australia.
A not-for-profit organisation has launched its arts exhibition, and all the profits will support artists with a disability. We'll have this and more for you over the next half hour. Thanks for being with us today. We're on air across Australia thanks to the Community Radio Network and the support from the Community Broadcasting Foundation. First up today, hundreds of AFL supporters are taking to the streets of Hobart tomorrow as voters head to the polls. The proposed Macquarie Point AFL Stadium in Hobart, endorsed by Labor and the Liberals, remains one of the biggest issues on the agenda for the state election. While recent polling from the Australian Institute suggests the stadium isn't wanted by most Tasmanians, supporters of the development are set to protest on the streets of Hobart tomorrow. Political reporter Noah Seckham spoke with Federal Independent MP Andrew Wilkie, who says the major parties are obsessed with the stadium and are losing sight of the real issues facing the state.
Well, as a voter, it was a weird combination of despair that we had another election being forced to vote for mostly the same mob who have let us down up till now, with the very real likelihood of them mostly being re-elected, and after many millions of dollars and months of campaigning, finding us back where we started. But it was also combined with some sense of relief, because we need some sort of circuit breaker in Tasmania. This state, it really is the jewel in the nation's crown, but it is easily the most poorly governed jurisdiction. We have debt going through the roof. We have issues like the health crisis, the housing crisis. We have so many problems that need challenging or need addressing, and all the time being swamped by a debate about a third AFL stadium we can't afford and don't need, and frankly most people don't want. So on one hand, an election was the last thing I wanted, but on the other hand, we need a circuit breaker, because otherwise we're just going to keep bumbling on the way we have been for a long time.
I'll circle back to that, but while you mentioned the fateful AFL stadium, a unique situation with the next federal parliament is that it's all Tasmanian representation is Labor, except for yourself in the lower house, and in that cohort is a former Labor leader in Rebecca White. Do you think that the federal government is actually going to be pressured to, you know, take more of a position on Tasmanian issues? And do you see that that could turn into a federal government issue, the stadium down here, if Labor should win on Saturday?
Well, the stadium is already a federal Labor issue, if only because federal Labor has committed, I think it's $240 million towards the Macquarie Point redevelopment. A decision by the federal government some time ago that still mystifies me, and in fact, back at the time, I advised Anthony Albanese personally to stay well away from it. I tried to impress upon him, as it turned out unsuccessfully, that we've already got two AFL stadiums. We don't need a third one, particularly within eyesight of another one, with a capacity at about the same. Belle Reeve's seating and standing capacity of 20,000, the new proposed stadium a seated capacity of 23,000. I mean, there are so many layers to this which are just bewildering. But I did say to the government at the time, the federal government, if you are going to go anywhere near it, then put your money into the surrounding investments, which has in to some degree become part of the way the federal funding commitment has evolved. I mean, there is a requirement in the deed of agreement between Canberra and the state government that money be spent on affordable housing, on repairing the wharf. So they've to some degree I think, taken good advice. But they are heavily invested. The Prime Minister was down here just recently and said publicly to the media, you know, just get on and do it. So he is invested. Why he's so invested, I don't understand. It's interesting that the state Labor Party went to the last state election with an anti-stadium position, but then within weeks of the election, backflipped to a pro-stadium position, which is one of the reasons a lot of long-time Labor voters are pretty unhappy with Labor at this state election. I guess listeners on the mainland will be curious as to why there is so much talk about one footy field in Tasmania. But I asked them to put themselves in our shoes down here. We're less than 600,000 people. We have a very small tax base. We have very, very high levels of public debt. We do have lots of problems with our healthcare system, with our housing, with our traffic congestion. When you have such a small place, with such a small population, with such big challenges, I hope people would understand why a government and the alternative governments just obsession with what seems to be a vanity project is all-consuming. Even though, interestingly, the motion of no confidence in Premier Jeremy Rockcliffe, which has indirectly forced his election, never even mentioned the stadium.
When we're looking at the fact that Tasmania is going to an election just 16 months after the last one, some academics I've spoken to have placed the blame partially on Crossbench, who wasn't working with the Liberal Party. Do you see this as at all an indictment on the Crossbench, on independence, on that movement as a whole?
No, well, the history of this has been quickly rewritten by the Liberal Party. The no confidence motion was in the Premier Jeremy Rockcliffe. It wasn't a no confidence motion in the government. It is rewriting history for the Liberal Party to now say that the opposition and the Crossbench forced an early election. No, they forced a successful vote of no confidence in the Premier.
Independent MP Andrew Wilkie there, speaking with Community Radio Network's Noah Seckham.
Across Australia, you're listening to The Wire, Community Radio's National Current Affairs program.
A new research from Charles Darwin University shows First Nations calendars can forecast solar power with an AI technique tool with a low error rate. At this point, predicting solar power generation is complex because of weather, atmospheric conditions, and how much power is absorbed on a panel surface. The predicting tool will help and support remote areas across Australia, and it also shows how Indigenous knowledge is essential. The Wire's Eduardo Jordan asked PhD student at Charles Darwin University and Bundjalung man Luke Hamlin to explain more about the research.
So the world's first study that uses First Nations calendars for solar power forecasting. So essentially the study combines First Nations seasonal calendars with a novel deep learning model, an artificial intelligence technique to predict future solar panel power output. So as I'm sure that you and many of your listeners can appreciate, solar is one of the world's leading renewable energy alternatives, but there continues to be challenges with the technology's reliability. So at present, solar power generation is difficult to predict because of weather, atmospheric conditions, and how much power is absorbed on a solar panel surface. So by weaving together deep learning with ecologically informed First Nations seasonality, this study delivers a more precise solar forecasting system, and that's essentially what the study is that we're doing at Charles Darwin University.
Now, look, for our audience who are unfamiliar, and probably I'm very unfamiliar with all this, could you please tell us in a nutshell the basis of the First Nations calendars you're using for the research and the differences between each one?
Yeah, okie dokie. So our research team at CDU developed the model using First Nations calendars in the Tiwi and other areas of northern parts of Australia. And so unlike conventional calendar systems, these seasonal insights are deeply rooted in local ecological cues, so such as plant and animal behaviours, which are closely aligned with environmental patterns tied to changes in sunlight and weather patterns. So we've used these inputs to combine them to deliver a more precise solar forecasting system. And that's essentially, yeah, what we're using and how we're using them.
How important is, according to the research, to incorporate First Nations knowledge in solar power generation prediction?
Yeah, okay, so Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people are the first peoples of this country, and it's really important that we take more approaches like this, not just to preserve our traditional knowledges, but to integrate them into Western ways of thinking. So there's a stat at the moment that indicates that 70% of our jobs over the next 10 years will be STEM-related. So it's also really important that we pave pathways for First Nations scientists by demonstrating a willingness to respect and understand these traditional knowledges while working alongside and reconciling them with Western ways of thinking.
And how is this research going to be useful, particularly in remote areas across Australia?
Yeah, okay. So right now in Australia, across Australia, including in rural, I mean regional and rural areas, significant renewable energy project development is underway, and some of those projects are driven by the First Nations Clean Energy Strategy. Given Australia's unique climate, in particular in rural and remote areas, we can really harness these knowledges and technologies in such a way that we can make renewables much more effective. So the success of the study suggests that it could be a valuable tool for advancing solar power generation prediction in rural areas.
And what's the future work of this research?
So the future, not just of this research, but technology in general, is really exciting. It's really exciting time to be in STEM at the moment. We're currently going through rapid advancements, growth and dependencies on technology, which can have quite a significant impact on society. So regarding our research specifically, we'll explore the application of the model to other regions and other renewable energy sources. And so with this in mind, integrating Indigenous knowledges into predictive models can more closely tailor a system to reflect the more nuanced shifts in environmental conditions.
So as an Aboriginal man, how this research is close to your mob and to your, well, to your environment, let's say?
Yeah, of course. So I'm a Bundjalung man from northern New South Wales, and we also have similar knowledges with respect to weather forecasting. And I think as a Bundjalung man, I'm quite passionate about integrating these ways of thinking into Western ways of thinking. And so that was one of my primary motivators for doing this study and working along some of the research team at Charles Darwin University. So for me, I'm really quite passionate about this project because once it's been further established, we can actually expand this way of thinking to other areas across Australia.
Luke Hamlin from Charles Darwin University there, speaking with The Wire's Eduardo Jordan. You're listening to The Wire, independent current affairs on community and Indigenous radio. I'm Tony Pankaluik in Brisbane. A big hello to our friends in Alice Springs on 8CCC, to our listeners in Armidale on Tune FM, and to the other side of the country to Radio Gulari in Broome, Western Australia. Artificial intelligence is now widespread and used across many sectors in society, including universities. In Australia, most university students lack any formal tuition on how to utilise AI ethically and responsibly. The issue has now led to calls for implementing AI ethics into tertiary education via curriculum reform. To learn more, I spoke with Academic Deputy Associate Dean of the University of Queensland's Faculty of Business Law and Economics, Associate Professor Rachel Fitzgerald.
So I think one of the interesting things is when I talk to students about the use of AI, and I'm not talking about it in terms of like using it for the context of doing their work, just generally when we're talking about it. One of the things I find quite interesting is that their concern about Gen AI particularly is around the impact it has on the climate. So they're very concerned about the data centers that are behind it and the amount of energy and water consumption that they need, because that's actually obviously what's coming through on social media. But there's much bigger issues as well that they need to be thinking about, which is about these black boxes that they're willing to put data into. I mean, our concerns are around, as I described them, as a black box. We don't know how it's processing data or the kind of data that it's using in order to give answers. So when it's reflecting what generally is stand out in society, as you may have seen examples from some of the recent reports about what Grok has done, from being very, very right-wing and responses to things and coming out with completely inappropriate responses to some people's queries. The same thing can happen on any of them. So we're talking about bias, and we're talking about amplifying societal bias that generally happens, but in a way that seems like it's a reasonable answer. And so we need, obviously, students to be very aware that that's what could be coming through. The other thing is around data security generally. I mean, being very conscious about the kind of data that you're feeding into these systems. And it's really important. And I think in some early examples that we've heard, you know, that's happened in classrooms where students just don't even think, they just upload anything. And that's something that we need to be addressing. We need to be conscious, mindful about what kind of information is valid to be sharing with, again, the concept of a black box. It's very easy for those AI companies to pinch themselves as a solution, but quite often the responses that you get back really needs careful reading. Think about why the answer is that they're giving you the way the answer is. Not always a good response.
So as we know, AI is basically everywhere around the world, and it's actually got me curious, before we get to Australia, what countries are undertaking AI literacy and ethics initiatives in their tertiary education sectors? Are there any examples that you know of?
The consistency of this is very uneven. So what's happening? And I guess it is something that around the world people are trying to address. So, you know, we shared some examples of actual institutions that are doing some interesting courses that brings in a combination of thinking. So looking at it from a philosophy point of view, but it's also looking at it from a technical point of view. And that multidisciplinary approach is really important. And some other examples of where it's been looked at on a bigger scale is like places like Singapore have got, you know, a national AI literacy that's actually targeting students. And Canada, the government have put up some funding specifically to look at ethical AI teaching and research. And I read an interesting LinkedIn post the other day, which again looks at the UK is looking at it on a national scale of what could they do. It's very early stages. But I guess every country is probably thinking that way. They just haven't really moved forward in a very obvious and consistent way so that we could talk specifically about examples of how that's really happening. So Australia would be moving, and there's certainly this conversation will be happening in every university. But because it's not really out there as here's how we're going to address it, that's why I think we're just really raising the idea that we need to have this the proper conversation, probably from a national level.
What's the situation like here in Australia? Where's it at?
So I think the biggest conversation that's really coming through in higher education has been around integrity, which it's a very important conversation to have about what we have to assure ourselves that the qualifications that our students have are the things that they've gathered themselves and they haven't had AI helping. And that's a really important part of the conversation. But it's just not the critical part of learning to use these tools. And as I said, like, I think a lot of institutions are having a conversation about what does responsible AI look like, but we do need to be thinking about putting something in place much quicker. And obviously my proposal is it actually becomes contextually part of the curriculum. So we really need to be building it into how we teach things and how to be thinking more critically about the kind of tools that we're engaging with.
So actually, let's talk more into that curriculum, like in how should it be successfully implemented across, say, the country? Like, what would it take to get attention and, say, the ball moving in that direction?
In an ideal circumstance, what we would have is probably a policy initiatives from the government, which would say that we want to position higher education as leaders on this, that we want to be developing our students to have this support, so there would be funding for that research and the curriculum changes. We'd be looking for national examples of good practice that we could share across. And this would actually be a key focus area, which of course that would cascade down, and then universities would then prioritize this as what we need to do. And then there'd be quite innovative ways of approaching how that should happen. In my mind, then that would be a true curriculum design support. So how it's built into teaching and learning. It would be about graduate capability, so students will be clear that this is one of the things that is really important part of their degrees. And I also would think that we need to have like a little bit of development around our academic staff to make sure that they're quite clear about this as well, because it's probably new for quite a lot of people.
That was Associate Professor Rachel Fitzgerald from the University of Queensland. An organization has launched in its fourth year an exhibition with the most diverse and inclusive art show across Australia. The Incognito Art Show is giving the opportunity for the public to buy every art piece at around $100, and all the profits will go to the programs supporting artists with a disability. The business model of this exhibition aims to bring art to those who sometimes are not exposed to it and democratizes art selection. The Wire's contributor from Tune FM, Ash Taylor, started asking co-founder of the Incognito Art Show, Dave Liston, how he got involved in the project.
I was working in Dublin in Ireland and in the business that I worked for about 10 years. And I on a weekend, I saw an art show over there, Incognito Art Show in Ireland, or it's just known as Incognito over there. And I took part as a buyer, and I thought that if such an interesting show can get me out of bed and waiting 3 hours in line for an artwork, then it's a pretty compelling offering. And I just thought that it was something that could work really well in Australia. So when I moved back to Australia in 2021, I got the show going here.
So have you always been a big fan of art? Are you an artist yourself, or is it sort of a spur of the moment thing of this is actually something really fantastic?
A bit of both. Like, I've always loved art. I studied art history. I did an arts degree at uni and majored in art history. And fantastic. I, you know, painted and stuff at school, but I'm by no means an artist, just more or less a fan, better at wrangling artists than creating art. So.
Which is difficult in and of itself, I'm told.
Absolutely, yeah.
How have you found its reception in Australia? You said this was really popular when you were over in Ireland, and how much you thought this would work really well here. What's the reception been so far?
Yeah, it's been awesome. The basic idea of the show is that we try to get anyone can take part. So we pitch ourselves as the most inclusive and art show in Australia. So whether you're amateur artists, emerging artists, never even painted before, you can take part in the show. Artists register on our website. We send out an artist pack. In the artist pack is 3 A5 cards. So half the size of an A4 bit of paper is A5. So it's like a big postcard. The artist produces the work on the cards, posts them back to us. We then in turn exhibit the art online all anonymously. So the, you know, number 1 to 22,000 artworks this year. So number 1 to 22,000. And so that's done by a range of artists, right, from amateur to professional. And it's in, we lead up to an in-person sale day. And there's 3 rules of the sale day. It's first in, best dressed. All artworks are $100. And you're limited to buying 3 artworks per person. Now, the twist in the show is you don't know who you're buying until you bought it. Now, you asked what the reception was like. In the first year we did this, we sort of, it was just a few friends and myself. It was just a little project. And we wanted to get 100 artworks. We ended up getting 1,800.
Wow.
So it was a big reception, and
that's incredible growth. I can't even really call it such a small beginnings when you had 1,800 to start with a goal of 100. That's phenomenal.
Yeah, I was well and truly prepared to paint 99 of them in that first year, but it wasn't necessary.
I don't want to obviously spoil anything for this year because artists have yet to be released, but have you found that you have had a number of these, like, you know, big artists joining in as much as, you know, kids and their families?
Yeah, absolutely. So, like, there's obviously, the bigger it gets, the less sort of professional artists you get just because there's a limited number of them. But if you went to this year's Win Sulman and Archibald Prize, 18 of the artists that are finalists in those prizes took part in Incognito.
Why was it so important to have it be as accessible as it is?
So there's a number of reasons. So Incognito is it's not for profit, and we raise money. The quid pro quo of artists giving us their work for free is that the money that we raise from the profits that we raise from the show get contributed to artists. So we partner with different arts organizations each year, but there's one primary organization we partner with every year. It's Studio A. And so it supports artists with intellectual disability. Now, it's not like art therapy. These are professional artists who happen to have Down syndrome or autism or the like and need additional support in terms of growing their practice. Studio A is a partner, and then this year our junior partner is the Art Factory in Wagga. They do a similar thing to Studio A. It's basically just a bush version of Studio A, and they're fantastic.
Have you found that AI has impacted the type of work that you are getting submitted to your art show?
Yeah, it's interesting. We do get a few sort of AI-influenced works. Now, I'm not like one way or the other, whether good or bad. I think high level, even before AI, mass creative production is so easy now. Like, you can make prints so easily. You can click of a button that can be shot out and sold to someone in Sweden in 2 days' time. And you can make sort of 3D printing as loud, sort of a boom in all sorts of creative activity. Now, that's great, but original one of one art, I think, will get even more valuable because of this sort of mass proliferation of creativity or sort of mass produced creativity.
Dave Liston from the Incognito Art Show there, speaking with Toon FM's Ash Taylor. And that's the end of the show today. Thanks so much for listening wherever you are in Australia. The Wire is a co-production between community radio stations 2SER, Radio Adelaide, 4ZZZ, and Radio 4EB in Melbourne and Brisbane, with the great support of the Community Broadcasting Foundation and the Community Radio Network. We'll see you next week, same time, on your local station. And if you'd like to listen to any one of our stories again, you can go to our website at thewire.org.au. The Wire acknowledges the traditional custodians of the Turrbal and Yuggera countries where this program has been produced, and we pay our respects to Aboriginal elders, past, present, and emerging. Today, The Wire came to you from Radio 4EB in Mianjin, Brisbane. I'm Tony Pankaluik. Thanks so much for your company, and we'll see you next time on The Wire.